comfortable office chair, I'd likely doze off. That probably sounds peculiar to you, given what had happened only an hour before, but I felt as if I'd lived three lifetimes since 11 o'clock the previous night, all of them without sleep. John Coffey was standing at his cell door, tears streaming from his strange, distant eyes. It was like watching blood run out of some unhealable but strangely painless wound. Closer to the desk, Wharton was sitting on his bunk, rocking from side to side, and singing a song, apparently of his own invention, and not quite nonsense. As well as I can remember, it went something like this. Barbecue me and you, stinky pinky, few few few. It wasn't Billy, or Philadelphia Philly. It wasn't Jackie or Roy. It was a warm little ember, a hot cucumber by the name of Delacroix. Shut up, you jerk, I said. Wharton grinned, showing his mouthful of dying teeth. He wasn't dying, at least not yet. He was up, happy, practically tap-dancing. Come on in here and make me, why don't you? He said happily, and then began another verse of the barbecue song, making up words not quite at random. There was something going on in there, all right. A kind of green and stinking intelligence that was, in its own way, almost brilliant. I went down to John Coffey. He wiped away his tears with the heels of his hands. His eyes were red and sore-looking, and it came to me that he was exhausted, too. Why, he should have been, a man who trudged around the exercise yard maybe 2 hours a day and either sat or laid down in his cell the rest of the time, I didn't know. But I didn't doubt what I was seeing. It was too clear. Poor Dell, he said in a low, hoarse voice. Poor old Dell. Yes, I said. Poor old Dell. John, are you okay? He's out of it, Coffey said. Dell's out of it, isn't he, boss? Yes. Answer my question, John. Are you okay?
Dell's out of it. He's the lucky one. No matter how it happened, he's the lucky one.
I thought Delacroix might have given him an argument on that, but didn't say so. I glanced around Coffey's cell instead. Where's Mr. Jingles?
Ran down there.
He pointed through the bars down the hall to the restraint room door. I nodded. Well, he'll be back. But he wasn't. Mr. Jingles' days on the Green Mile were over. The only trace of him we ever happened on was what Brutal found that winter, a few brightly colored splinters of wood and a smell of peppermint candy wafting out of a hole in a beam. I meant to walk away then, but I didn't. I looked at John Coffey, and he back at me as if he knew everything I was thinking. I told myself to get moving. To just call it a night and get moving, back to the duty desk and my report. Instead, I said his name. John Coffey.
Yes, boss, he said at once.
Sometimes a man is cursed with needing to know a thing, and that was how it was with me right then. I dropped down on one knee and began taking off one of my shoes. Chapter 7. The rain had quit by the time I got home, and a late grin of moon had appeared over the ridges to the north. My sleepiness seemed to have gone with the clouds. I was wide awake, and I could smell Delacroix on me. I thought I might smell him on my skin, barbecue me and you, stinky pinky, few few few. For a long time to come. Janice was waiting up, as she always did on execution nights. I meant not to tell her the story, saw no sense in harrowing her with it. But she got a clear look at my face as I came in the kitchen door, and would have it all. So I sat down took her warm hands in my cold ones. The heater in my old Ford barely worked, and the weather had turned 180 degrees since the storm, and told her what she thought she wanted to hear. About halfway through, I broke down crying, which I hadn't expected. I was a little ashamed, but only a little. It was her, you see. And she never taxed me with the times that I slipped from the way I thought a man should be. The way I thought I should be, at any rate. A man with a good wife is the luckiest of God's creatures, and one without must be among the most miserable, I think, the only true blessing of their lives that they don't know how poorly off they are. I cried, and she held my head against her breast, and when my own storm passed, I felt better. A little, anyway. And I believe that was when I had the first conscious sight of my idea. Not the shoe. I don't mean that. The shoe was related, but different. All my real idea was right then, however, was an odd realization. That John Coffey and Melinda Moores, different as they might have been in size and sex and color, had exactly the same eyes. Woeful, sad, and distant. Dying eyes. "Come to bed," my wife said at last. "Come to bed with me, Paul." So I did, and we made love. And when it was over, she went to sleep. As I lay there, watching the moon grin and listening to the walls tick, they were at last pulling in, exchanging summer for fall, I thought about John Coffey saying he had helped it. "I helped Dell's mouse. I helped Mr. Jingles. He's a circus mouse." Sure. And maybe I thought we were all circus mice, running around with only the dimmest awareness that God and all his heavenly host were watching us in our Bakelite houses through our ivy glass windows. I slept a little as the day began to lighten. 2 hours, I guess, maybe three. And I slept the way I always sleep these days here at Georgia Pines, and hardly ever did then, in thin little licks. What I went to sleep thinking about was the churches of my youth. The names changed, depending on the whims of my mother and her sisters, but they were all really the same. All the First Backwoods Church of Praise Jesus the Lord is Mighty. In the shadow of those blunt square steeples, the concept of atonement came up as regularly as the toll of the bell which called the faithful to worship. Only God could forgive sins, could and did, washing them away in the agonal blood of his crucified Son, but that did not change the responsibility of his children to atone for those sins and even their simple errors of judgment whenever possible. Atonement was powerful. It was the lock on the door you closed against the past. I fell asleep, thinking of Piney Woods' atonement, and Edouard Delacroix on fire as he rode the lightning, and Melinda Moores, and my big boy with the endlessly weeping eyes. These thoughts twisted their way into a dream. In it, John Coffey was sitting on a riverbank and bawling his inarticulate mooncalf's grief up at the early summer sky, while on the other bank a freight train stormed endlessly toward a rusty trestle spanning the Trepingus. In the crook of each arm, the black man held the body of a naked, blonde-haired girl child. His fists, huge brown rocks at the ends of those arms, were closed. All around him crickets chirred, and no seums flocked. The day hummed with heat. In my dream, I went to him, knelt before him, and took his hands. His fists relaxed and gave up their secrets. In one was a spool, colored green and red and yellow. In the other was a prison guard's shoe.
"I couldn't help it," John Coffey said. "I tried to take it back, but it was too late."
And this time, in my dream, I understood him. Chapter 8. At 9 o'clock the next morning, while I was having a third cup of coffee on the porch, my wife said nothing, but I could see disapproval writ large on her face when she brought it to me, the telephone rang. I went into the parlor to take it, and Central told someone that their party was holding the line. She then told me to have a birdlarky day and rang off, presumably. With Central, you could never quite tell for sure. Hal Moores's voice shocked me. Wavery and hoarse, it sounded like the voice of an octogenarian. It occurred to me that it was good that things had gone all right with Curtis Anderson in the tunnel last night, good that he felt about the same as we did about Percy, because this man I was talking to would very likely never work another day at Cold Mountain. "Paul, I understand there was trouble last night. I also understand that our friend Mr. Wetmore was involved." "A spot of trouble," I admitted, holding the receiver tight to my ear and leaning in toward the horn. "But the job got done, that's the important thing." "Yes, of course." "Can I ask who told you? So I can tie a can to his tail," I didn't add. "You can ask, but since it's really none of your beeswax, I think I'll keep my mouth shut on that score. But when I called my office to see if there were any messages or urgent business, I was told an interesting thing."
"Oh?"
"Yes. Seems a transferral application landed in my basket. Percy Wetmore wants to go to Briar Ridge as soon as possible. Must have filled out the application even before last night's shift was over, wouldn't you think?"
"It sounds that way," I agreed.
"Ordinarily, I'd let Curtis handle it, but considering the atmosphere on E Block just lately, I asked Hannah to run it over to me personally on her lunch hour. She has graciously agreed to do so. I'll approve it and see it's forwarded on to the state capitol this afternoon. I expect you'll get a look at Percy's backside going out the door no more than a month, maybe less."
He expected me to be pleased with this news, and had a right to expect it. He had taken time out from tending his wife to expedite a matter that might otherwise have taken upwards of half a year, even with Percy's vaunted connections. Nevertheless, my heart sank. A month. But maybe it didn't matter much, one way or the other. It removed a perfectly natural desire to wait and put off a risky endeavor, and what I was now thinking about would be very risky indeed. Sometimes, when that's the case, it's better to jump before you can lose your nerve. If we were going to have to deal with Percy in any case, always assuming I could get the others to go along with my insanity, always assuming there was a we, in other words, it might as well be tonight.
"Paul? Are you there?"
His voice lowered a little, as if he thought he was now talking to himself.
"Damn, I think I lost the connection."
"No, I'm here, Al. That's great news."
"Yes,"
he agreed, and I was again struck by how old he sounded, how papery, somehow.
"Oh, I know what you're thinking."
"No, you don't, Warden," I thought. "Never in a million years could you know what I'm thinking."
"You're thinking that our young friend will still be around for the coffee execution." "That's probably true. Coffee will go well before Thanksgiving, I imagine. But you can put him back in the switch room. No one will object, including him, I should think."
"I'll do that," I said. "Al, how's Melinda?" There was a long pause. So long I might have thought I'd lost him, except for the sound of his breathing. When he spoke this time, it was in a much lower tone of voice.
"She's sinking," he said.
Sinking. That chilly word the old-timers used not to describe a person who was dying, exactly, but one who had begun to uncouple from living.
"The headache seemed a little better, for now, anyway, but she can't walk without help, she can't pick things up, she loses control of her water while she sleeps."
There was another pause, and then in an even lower voice, Hal said something that sounded like, "She wears." "Wears what, Hal?" I asked, frowning. My wife had come into the parlor doorway. She stood there wiping her hands on a dish towel and looking at me. "No," he said, in a voice that seemed to waver between anger and tears. "She swears." "Oh." I still didn't know what he meant, but had no intention of pursuing it. I didn't have to. He did it for me.
"She'll be all right. Perfectly normal, talking about her flower garden, or a dress she saw in the catalog, or maybe about how she heard Roosevelt on the radio and how wonderful he sounds. And then all at once she'll start to say the most awful things, the most awful words. She doesn't raise her voice. It would almost be better if she did, I think, because then, you see, then
she wouldn't sound so much like herself."
"That's it," he said gratefully. "But to hear her saying those awful gutter language things in her sweet voice. Pardon me, Paul."
His voice trailed away, and I heard him noisily clearing his throat. Then he came back, sounding a little stronger, but just as distressed.
"She wants to have Pastor Donaldson over, and I know he's a comfort to her, but how can I ask him? Suppose that he's sitting there reading scripture with her, and she calls him a foul name. She could. She called me one last night. She said, 'Hand me that Liberty magazine, you cocksucker, would you?' Paul, where could she have ever heard such language? How could she know those words?"
"I don't know. Hal, are you going to be home this evening?" When he was well and in charge of himself, not distracted by worry or grief, Hal Moore's had a cutting and sarcastic facet to his personality. His subordinates feared that side of him even more than his anger or his contempt, I think. His sarcasm, usually impatient and often harsh, could sting like acid. A little of that now splashed on me. It was unexpected, but on the whole, I was glad to hear it. All the fight hadn't gone out of him after all, it seemed.
"No," he said, "I'm taking Melinda out square dancing. We're going to do-si-do, Alamand left, and then tell the fiddler he's a rooster-dick motherfucker."
I clapped my hand over my mouth to keep from laughing. Mercifully, it was an urge that passed in a hurry.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I haven't been getting much sleep lately. It's made me grouchy."
"Of course we're going to be home. Why do you ask?"
"It doesn't matter, I guess," I said.
"You weren't thinking of coming by, were you? Because if you were on last night, you'll be on tonight, unless you've switched with somebody."
"No, I haven't switched," I said. "I'm on tonight."
"It wouldn't be a good idea anyway. Not the way she is right now."
"Maybe not. Thanks for your news."
"You're welcome. Pray for my Melinda, Paul."
I said I would, thinking that I might do quite a bit more than pray. God helps those who help themselves, as they say in the Church of Praise Jesus, the Lord is mighty. I hung up and looked at Janice.
"How's Melly?"
she asked.
"Not good."
I told her what Hal had told me, including the part about the swearing, although I left out cocksucker and rooster dick motherfucker. I finished with Hal's word, sinking, and Jan nodded sadly. Then she took a closer look at me.
"What are you thinking about? You're thinking about something, probably no good. It's in your face."
Lying was out of the question. It wasn't the way we were with each other. I just told her it was best she not know, at least for the time being.
"Is it... could it get you in trouble?"
She didn't sound particularly alarmed at the idea, more interested than anything, which is one of the things I have always loved about her.
"Maybe," I said. "Is it a good thing?"
"Maybe," I repeated. I was standing there, still turning the phone's crank idly with one finger while I held down the connecting points with a finger of my other hand.
"Would you like me to leave you alone while you use the telephone?" she asked. "Be a good little woman and butt out, do some dishes, knit some booties?"
I nodded. That's not the way I'd put it, but are we having extras for lunch, Paul?
I hope so, I said.
Chapter 9. I got Brutal and Dean right away because both of them were on the exchange. Harry wasn't, not then at least, but I had the number of his closest neighbor who was. Harry called me back about 20 minutes later, highly embarrassed at having to reverse the charges and sputtering promises to pay his share when our next bill came. I told him we'd count those chickens when they hatched. In the meantime, could he come over to my place for lunch? Brutal and Dean would be here, and Janice had promised to put out some of her famous slaw, not to mention her even more famous apple pie.
Lunch just for the hell of it?
Harry sounded skeptical. I admitted I had something I wanted to talk to them about, but it was best not gone into even lightly over the phone. Harry agreed to come. I dropped the receiver onto the prongs, went to the window, and looked out thoughtfully. Although we'd had the late shift, I hadn't awakened either Brutal or Dean, and Harry hadn't sounded like a fellow freshly turned out of dreamland either. It seemed that I wasn't the only one having problems with what had happened last night. And considering the craziness I had in mind, that was probably good. Brutal, who lived closest to me, arrived at 11:15. Dean showed up 15 minutes later, and Harry, already dressed for work, about 15 minutes after Dean. Janice served us cold beef sandwiches, slaw, and iced tea in the kitchen. Only a day before, we would have had it out on the side porch and been glad of a breeze, but the temperature had dropped a good 15 degrees since the thunderstorm, and a keen-edged wind was snuffling down from the ridges. "You're welcome to sit down with us," I told my wife. She shook her head.
"I don't think I want to know what you're up to. I'll worry less if I'm in the dark. I'll have a bite in the parlor. I'm visiting with Miss Jane Austen this week, and she's very good company."
"Who's Jane Austen?" Harry asked when she had left. "Your side or Janice's, Paul? A cousin? Is she pretty?"
"She's all right, you nit," Brutal told him. "Been dead practically since Betsy Ross basted the stars on the first flag."
"Oh," Harry looked embarrassed. "I'm not much of a reader. Radio manuals, mostly."
"What's on your mind, Paul?" Dean asked.
"John Coffey and Mr. Jingles, to start with." They looked surprised, which I had expected. They'd been thinking I wanted to discuss either Delacroix or Percy, maybe both. I looked at Dean and Harry. The thing with Mr. Jingles, what Coffey did, happened pretty fast. I don't know if he got there in time to see how broken up the mouse was or not. Dean shook his head.
"I saw the blood on the floor, though."
I turned to Brutal.
"That son of a bitch Percy crushed it," he said simply. "It should have died, but it didn't. Coffey did something to it. Healed it somehow. I know how that sounds, but I saw it with my own eyes."
I said, "He healed me as well. And I didn't just see it. I felt it." I told them about my urinary infection, how it had come back, how bad it had been. I pointed through the window at the woodpile I'd had to hold on to the morning the pain drove me to my knees, and how it had gone away completely after Coffey touched me, and stayed away. It didn't take long to tell. When I was done, they sat and thought about it a while, chewing on their sandwiches as they did. Then Dean said,
"Black things came out of his mouth, like bugs."
"That's right," Harry agreed. "They were black to start with, anyway. Then they turned white and disappeared."
He looked around, considering.
"It's like I damn near forgot the whole thing until you brought it up, Paul. Ain't that funny?"
"Nothing funny or strange about it," Brutal said. "I think that's what people most always do with the stuff they can't make out. Just forget it. Doesn't do a person much good to remember stuff that doesn't make any sense. What about it, Paul? Were there bugs when he fixed you?"
"Yes. I think they're the sickness, the pain, the hurt. He takes it in and lets it out into the open air again."
"Where it dies," Harry said.
I shrugged. I didn't know if it died or not. Wasn't sure it even mattered.
"Did he suck it out of you?" Brutal asked. "He looked like he was sucking it right out of the mouse. The hurt, the, you know, the
death? No, I said. He just touched me. And I felt it. A kind of jolt, like electricity, only not painful. But I wasn't dying, only hurting. Brutal nodded. The touch and the breath. Just like you hear those backwoods gospel shouters going on about. Praise Jesus, the Lord is mighty, I said. I don't know if Jesus comes into it, Brutal said, but it seems to me like John Coffey is one mighty man. All right, Dean said. If you say all this happened, I guess I believe it. God works in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. But what's it got to do with us? Well, that was the big question, wasn't it? I took in a deep breath and told them what I wanted to do. They listened, dumbfounded. Even Brutal, who liked to read those magazines with the stories about little green men from space, looked dumbfounded. There was a longer silence when I finished this time, and no one chewing any sandwiches. At last, in a gentle and reasonable voice, Brutus Hall said, "We'd lose our jobs if we were caught, Paul. And we'd be very goddamn lucky if that was all that happened. We'd probably end up over in A-block as guests of the state, making wallets and showering in pairs." "Yes," I said, "that could happen." "I can understand how you feel a little," he went on. "You know Moore's better than us. He's your friend, as well as the big boss, and I know you think a lot of his wife." "She's the sweetest woman you could ever hope to meet," I said. "And she means the world to him." "But we don't know her the way you and Janice do," Brutal said. "Do we, Paul?" "You'd like her if you did," I said. "At least you'd like her if you'd met her before this thing got its claws into her. She does a lot of community things. She's a good friend, and she's religious. More than that, she's funny. Used to be, anyhow. She could tell you things that'd make you laugh until the tears rolled down your cheeks. But none of those things are the reason I want to help save her, if she can be saved. What's happening to her is an offense, goddammit, an offense to the eyes and the ears and the heart. Very noble. But I doubt like hell if that's what put this bee in your bonnet," Brutal said. "I think it's what happened to Dell. You want to balance it off somehow." And he was right. Of course he was. I knew Melinda Moore's better than the others did, but maybe not, in the end, well enough to ask them to risk their jobs for her, and possibly their freedom as well. Or my own job and freedom, for that matter. I had 2 grown children, and the last thing on God's earth that I wanted my wife to have to do was to write them the news that their father was going on trial for... well, what would it be? I didn't know for sure. Aiding and abetting an escape attempt seemed the most likely. But the death of Edouard Delacroix had been the ugliest, foulest thing I had ever seen in my life. Not just my working life, but my whole entire life, and I had been a party to it. We had all been a party to it, because we had allowed Percy Wetmore to stay even after we knew he was horribly unfit to work in a place like E-Block. We had played the game. Even Warden Moore's had been a party to it. "Is not to go on to cook whether Wetmore's on the team or not," he had said, and maybe that was well enough, considering what the little Frenchman had done. But in the end, Percy had done a lot more than cook Dell's nuts. He had blown the little man's eyeballs right out of their sockets and set his damned face on fire. And why? Because Dell was a murderer half a dozen times over? No. Because Percy had wet his pants, and the little Cajun had had the temerity to laugh at him. We'd been part of a monstrous act, and Percy was going to get away with it. Off to Briar Ridge he would go, happy as a clam at high tide, and there he would have a whole asylum filled with lunatics to practice his cruelties upon. There was nothing we could do about that, but perhaps it was not too late to wash some of the muck off our own hands. "In my church they call it atonement instead of balancing," I said. "But I guess it comes to the same thing." "Do you really think Coffey could save her?" Dean asked in a soft, awed voice. "Just
What, suck that brain tumor out of her head like it was a peach pit?
I think he could. It's not for sure, of course, but after what he did to me and to Mr. Jingles...
That mouse was seriously busted up, all right, Brutal said.
But would he do it? Harry mused. Would he?
If he can, he will, I said.
Why? Coffee doesn't even know her.
Because it's what he does. It's what God made him for. Brutal made a show of looking around, reminding us all that someone was missing.
What about Percy? You think he's just going to let this go down? He asked.
And so I told them what I had in mind for Percy. By the time I finished, Harry and Dean were looking at me in amazement, and a reluctant grin of admiration had dawned on Brutal's face.
Pretty audacious, Brother Paul, he said. Fair takes my breath away. But wouldn't it be the bee's knees?
Dean almost whispered, then laughed aloud and clapped his hands like a child.
I mean vo-do-de-o-do in 23 skidoo!
You want to remember that Dean had a special interest in the part of my plan that involved Percy. Percy could have gotten Dean killed, after all, freezing up the way he had.
Yeah, but what about after? Harry said.
He sounded gloomy, but his eyes gave him away. They were sparkling, the eyes of a man who wants to be convinced.
What then?
They say dead men tell no tales, Brutal rumbled, and I took a quick look at him to make sure he was joking.
I think he'll keep his mouth shut, I said.
Really?
Dean looked skeptical. He took off his glasses and began to polish them.
Convince me.
First, he won't know what really happened. He's going to judge us by himself and think it was just a prank. Second, and more important, he'll be afraid to say anything. That's what I'm really counting on. We tell him that if he starts writing letters and making phone calls, we start writing letters and making phone calls.
About the execution, Harry said.
And about the way he froze when Wharton attacked Dean, Brutal said. I think people finding out about that is what Percy Wetmore's really afraid of.
He nodded slowly and thoughtfully.
It could work. But, Pa, wouldn't it make more sense to bring Mrs. Moore's to Coffee than Coffee to Mrs. Moore's? We could take care of Percy pretty much the way you laid it out, then bring her in through the tunnel instead of taking Coffee out that way.
I shook my head. Never happen. Not in a million years.
Because of Warden Moore's.
That's right. He's so hard-headed he makes old Doubting Thomas look like Joan of Arc. If we bring Coffee to his house, I think we can surprise him into at least letting Coffee make the try. Otherwise...
What were you thinking about using for a vehicle?
Brutal asked. My first thought was the stagecoach, I said, but we'd never get it out of the yard without being noticed, and everyone within a 20-mile radius knows what it looks like anyway. I guess maybe we can use my Ford.
Guess again! Dean said, popping his specs back onto his nose. You couldn't get John Coffee into your car if you stripped him naked, covered him with lard, and used a shoehorn. You're so used to looking at him that you've forgotten how big he is.
I had no reply to that. Most of my attention that morning had been focused on the problem of Percy and the lesser but not inconsiderable problem of Wild Bill Wharton. Now I realized that transportation wasn't going to be as simple as I had hoped. Harry Terwilliger picked up the remains of his second sandwich, looked at it for a second, then put it down again.
"If we was to actually do this crazy thing," he said, "I guess we could use my pickup truck. Sit him in the back of that. Wouldn't be nobody much on the roads at that hour. We're talking about well after midnight, ain't we?"
"Yes," I said.
"You guys are forgetting one thing," Dean said. "I know Coffee's been pretty quiet ever since he came on the block. Doesn't do much but lay there on his bunk and leak from the eyes, but he's a murderer. Also, he's huge. If he decided he wanted to escape out of the back of Harry's truck, the only way we could stop him would be to shoot him dead. And a guy like that would take a lot of killing, even with a .45. Suppose we weren't able to put him down. And suppose he killed someone else. I'd hate losing my job, and I'd hate going to jail. I got a wife and kids depending on me to put bread in their mouths, but I don't think I'd hate either of those things near as much as having another dead little girl on my conscience.
That won't happen, I said.
How in God's name can you be so sure of that?
I didn't answer. I didn't know just how to begin. I had known this would come up. Of course I did, but I still didn't know how to start telling them what I knew. Brutal helped me.
You don't think he did it, do you, Paul?
He looked incredulous.
You think that big lug is innocent?
I'm positive he's innocent, I said.
How in the name of Jesus can you be?
There are two things, I said. One of them is my shoe. I leaned forward over the table and began talking.
Part 5. Night Journey.
Chapter 1. Mr. H. G. Wells once wrote a story about a man who invented a time machine. And I have discovered that in the writing of these memoirs, I have created my own time machine. Unlike Wells's, it can only travel into the past, back to 1932, as a matter of fact, when I was the Bull Goose Screw in E Block of Cold Mountain State Penitentiary. But it's eerily efficient for all that. Still, this time machine reminds me of the old Ford I had in those days. You could be sure that it would start eventually, but you never knew if a turn of the key would be enough to fire the motor, or if you were going to have to get out and crank until your arm practically fell off. I've had a lot of easy starts since I started telling the story of John Coffey, but yesterday I had to crank. I think it was because I'd gotten to Delacroix's execution, and part of my mind didn't want to have to relive that. It was a bad death. A terrible death. And it happened the way it did because of Percy Wetmore, a young man who loved to comb his hair but couldn't stand to be laughed at, not even by a half-bald little Frenchman who was never going to see another Christmas. As with most dirty jobs, however, the hardest part is just getting started. It doesn't matter to an engine whether you use the key or have to crank. Once you get it going, it'll usually run just as sweet either way. That's how it worked for me yesterday. At first the words came in little bursts of phrasing, then in whole sentences, then in a torrent. Writing is a special and rather terrifying form of remembrance, I've discovered. There is a totality to it that seems almost like rape. Perhaps I only feel that way because I've become a very old man, a thing that happened behind my own back, I sometimes think. But I don't think so. I believe that the combination of pencil and memory creates a kind of practical magic, and magic is dangerous. As a man who knew John Coffey and saw what he could do to mice and to men, I feel very qualified to say that. Magic is dangerous. In any case, I wrote all day yesterday, the words simply flooding out of me. The sunroom of this glorified old folks' home gone, replaced by the storage room at the end of the Green Mile, where so many of my problem children took their last sit-me-down, and the bottom of the stairs which led to the tunnel under the road. That was where Dean and Harry and Brutal and I confronted Percy Wetmore over Edouard Delacroix's smoking body, and made Percy renew his promise to put in for transfer to the Briar Ridge State Mental Facility. There are always fresh flowers in the sunroom, but by noon yesterday all I could smell was the noxious aroma of the dead man's cooked flesh. The sound of the power mower down below had been replaced by the hollow plink of dripping water as it seeped slowly through the tunnel's curved roof. The trip was on. I had traveled back to 1932, in soul and mind, if not body. I skipped lunch, wrote until 4 o'clock or so, and when I finally put my pencil down, my hand was aching. I walked slowly down to the end of the second floor corridor. There's a window there that looks out on the employee parking lot. Brad Dolan, the guard who reminds me of Percy, and the one who is altogether too curious about where I go and what I do on my walks, drives an old Chevrolet with a bumper sticker that says, "I have seen God, and his name is Newt." It was gone. Brad's shift was over, and he'd taken himself off to whatever garden spot he calls home. I envision an Airstream trailer with Hustler gatefolds scotch-taped to the walls and Dixie beer cans in the corners. I went out through the kitchen where dinner preparations were getting started. "What you got in that bag, Mr. Edgecombe?" Norton asked me. "It's an empty bottle," I said. "I've discovered the Fountain of Youth down there in the woods. I pop down every afternoon about this time and draw a little. I drink it at bedtime. Good stuff, I can tell you." "Maybe keeping you young," said George, the other cook, "but it ain't doing shit for your looks." We all had a laugh at that, and I went out. I found myself looking around for Dolan, even though his car was gone, called myself a chump for letting him get so far under my skin, and crossed the croquet course. Beyond it is a scraggy little putting green that looks ever so much nicer in the Georgia Pines brochures, and beyond that is a path that winds into the little copse of woods east of the nursing home. There are a couple of old sheds along this path, neither of them used for anything these days. At the second, which stands close to the high stone wall between the Georgia Pines grounds and Georgia Highway 47, I went in and stayed for a little while. I ate a good dinner that night, watched a little TV, and went to bed early. On many nights I'll wake up and creep back down to the TV room where I watch old movies on the American Movie Channel. Not last night, though. Last night I slept like a stone, and with none of the dreams that have so haunted me since I started my adventures in literature. All that writing yesterday must have worn me out. I'm not as young as I used to be, you know. When I woke and saw that the patch of sun which usually lies on the floor at 6 in the morning had made it all the way up to the foot of my bed, I hit the deck in a hurry, so alarmed I hardly noticed the arthritic flare of pain in my hips and knees and ankles. I dressed as fast as I could, then hurried down the hall to the window that overlooks the employees' parking lot, hoping the slot where Dolan parks his old Chevrolet would still be empty. Sometimes he's as much as a half hour late. No such luck. The car was there, gleaming rustily in the morning sun. Because Mr. Brad Dolan has something to arrive on time for these days, doesn't he? Yes, old Polly Edgecombe goes somewhere in the early mornings. Old Polly Edgecombe does something, and Mr. Brad Dolan intends to find out what it is. "What do you do down there, Polly? Tell me." He would likely be watching for me already. It would be smart to stay right where I was. Except I couldn't. "Paul?" I turned around so fast I almost fell down. It was my friend Elaine Connolly. Her eyes widened, and she put out her hands as if to catch me. Lucky for her, I caught my balance. Elaine's arthritis is terrible, and I probably would have broken her in two like a dry stick if I'd fallen into her arms. Romance doesn't die when you pass into the strange country that lies beyond 80. But you can forget the gun with the wind crap.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to startle you."
"That's all right," I said, and gave her a feeble smile. "It's a better wake-up than a face full of cold water. I should hire you to do it every morning."
"You were looking for his car, weren't you? Dolan's car."
There was no sense kidding her about it, so I nodded. "I wish I could be sure he's over in the West Wing. I'd like to slip out for a little while, but I don't want him to see me." She smiled, a ghost of the teasing imp smile she must have had as a girl.
Nosy bastard, isn't he?
Yes.
He's not in the West Wing either. I've already been down to breakfast, sleepyhead, and I can tell you where he is because I peeked. He's in the kitchen.
I looked at her, dismayed. I had known Dolan was curious, but not how curious.
Can you put your morning walk off?
Elaine asked. I thought about it. I could, I suppose, but you shouldn't. No, I shouldn't. Now, I thought, she'll ask me where I go, what I have to do down in those woods that's so damned important.
But she didn't.
Instead, she gave me that imp smile again. It looked strange and absolutely wonderful on her too gaunt, pain-haunted face.
"Do you know Mr. Howland?" she asked.
"Sure," I said, although I didn't see him much. He was in the West Wing, which at Georgia Pines was almost like a neighboring country. "Why?"
"Do you know what's special about him?"
I shook my head.
"Mr. Howland," Elaine said, smiling more widely than ever, "is one of only 5 residents left at Georgia Pines who have permission to smoke. That's because he was a resident before the rules changed."
A grandfather clause, I thought, and what place was more fitted for one than an old age home? She reached into the pocket of her blue and white striped robe and pulled 2 items partway out, a cigarette and a book of matches.
"Thief of green, thief of red," she sang in a lilting, funny voice. "Little Ellie's going to wet the bed."
"Elaine, what walk an old girl downstairs," she said, putting the cigarette and matches back into her pocket and taking my arm in one of her gnarled hands. We began to walk back down the hall. As we did, I decided to give up and put myself in her hands. She was old and brittle, but not stupid. As we went down, walking with the glassy care of the relics we have now become, Elaine said,
"Wait at the foot. I'm going over to the West Wing, to the hall toilet there. You know the one I mean, don't you?"
"Yes," I said, "the one just outside the spa. But why?"
"I haven't had a cigarette in over 15 years," she said, "but I feel like one this morning. I don't know how many puffs it'll take to set off the smoke detector in there, but I intend to find out."
I looked at her with dawning admiration, thinking how much she reminded me of my wife. Jan might have done exactly the same thing. Elaine looked back at me, smiling her saucy imp smile. I cupped my hand around the back of her lovely long neck, drew her face to mine, and kissed her mouth lightly. "I love you, Ellie," I said.
"Ooh, such big talk," she said, but I could tell she was pleased.
"What about Chuck Howland?" I asked. "Is he going to get in trouble?"
"No, because he's in the TV room watching Good Morning America with about 2 dozen other folks. And I'm going to make myself scarce as soon as the smoke detector turns on the West Wing fire alarm."
"Don't you fall down and hurt yourself, woman. I'd never forgive myself if..."
"Oh, stop your fussing," she said.
And this time she kissed me. Love among the ruins. It probably sounds funny to some of you and grotesque to the rest of you, but I'll tell you something, my friend. Weird love's better than no love at all. I watched her walk away, moving slowly and stiffly, but she will only use a cane on wet days, and only then if the pain is terrible, it's one of her vanities, and waited. 5 minutes went by, then 10, and just as I was deciding she had either lost her courage or discovered that the battery of the smoke detector in the toilet was dead, the fire alarm went off in the West Wing with a loud, buzzing burr. I started toward the kitchen at once, but slowly. There was no reason to hurry until I was sure Dolan was out of my way. A gaggle of old folks, most still in their robes, came out of the TV room. Here it's called the Resource Center. Now that's grotesque. to see what was going on. Chuck Howland was among them, I was happy to see. "Edgecombe!" Kent Avery rasped, hanging onto his walker with one hand and yanking obsessively at the crotch of his pajama pants with the other. "Real alarm or just another falsie? What do you think?" "No way of knowing, I guess," I said. Just about then, three orderlies went trotting past, all headed for the West Wing, yelling at the folks clustered around the TV room door to go outside and wait for the all clear. The third in line was Brad Dolan. He didn't even look at me as he went past, a fact that pleased me to no end. As I went on down toward the kitchen, it occurred to me that the team of Elaine Connolly and Paul Edgecombe would probably be a match for a dozen Brad Dolans, with half a dozen Percy Wetmores thrown in for good measure. The cooks in the kitchen were continuing to clear up breakfast, paying no attention to the howling fire alarm at all.
"Say, Mr. Edgecombe," George said, "I believe Brad Dolan been looking for you. In fact, you just missed him."
Lucky me, I thought. What I said out loud was that I'd probably see Mr. Dolan later. Then I asked if there was any leftover toast lying around from breakfast.
"Sure," Norton said, "but it's stone cold dead in the market. You running late this morning."
"I am," I agreed, "but I'm hungry."
"Only take a minute to make some fresh and hot," George said, reaching for the bread.
"Nope, cold'll be just fine," I said. And when he handed me a couple of slices, looking mystified, actually both of them looked mystified, I hurried out the door, feeling like the boy I once was, skipping school to go fishing with a jelly foldover wrapped in waxed paper slipped into the front of my shirt. Outside the kitchen door, I took a quick, reflexive look around for Dolan, saw nothing to alarm me, and hurried across the croquet course and putting green, gnawing on one of my pieces of toast as I went. I slowed a little as I entered the shelter of the woods, and as I walked down the path, I found my mind turning to the day after Edouard Delacroix's terrible execution. I had spoken to Hal Moores that morning, and he had told me that Melinda's brain tumor had caused her to lapse into bouts of cursing and foul language, what my wife had later labeled, rather tentatively, she wasn't sure it was really the same thing, as Tourette's syndrome. The quavering in his voice, coupled with the memory of how John Coffey had healed both my urinary infection and the broken back of Delacroix's pet mouse, had finally pushed me over the line that runs between just thinking about a thing and actually doing a thing. And there was something else. Something that had to do with John Coffey's hands and my shoe. So I had called the men I worked with, the men I had trusted my life to over the years, Dean Stanton, Harry Terwilliger, Brutus Howell. They came to lunch at my house on the day after Delacroix's execution, and they at least listened to me when I outlined my plan. Of course, they all knew that Coffey had healed the mouse. Brutal had actually seen it. So when I suggested that another miracle might result if we took John Coffey to Melinda Moore's, they didn't outright laugh. It was Dean Stanton who raised the most troubling question. What if John Coffey escaped while we had him out on his field trip?
"Suppose he killed someone else," Dean asked. "I'd hate losing my job, and I'd hate going to jail. I got a wife and kids depending on me to put bread in their mouths. But I don't think I'd hate either of those things near as much as having another little dead girl on my conscience."
There was silence then, all of them looking at me, waiting to see how I'd respond. I knew everything would change if I said what was on the tip of my tongue. We had reached a point beyond which retreat would likely become impossible. Except retreat for me, at least, was already impossible. I opened my mouth and said... Chapter 2 "That won't happen."
"How in God's name can you be so sure of that?" Dean asked.
I didn't answer. I didn't know just how to begin. I had known this would come up, Of course I had, but I still didn't know how to start telling them what was in my head and heart. Brutal helped.
You don't think he did it, do you, Paul?
He looked incredulous.
You think that big lug is innocent?
I'm positive he's innocent, I said.
How in the name of Jesus can you be?
There are two things, I said. One of them is my shoe.
Your shoe? Brutal exclaimed. What in God's name has your shoe got to do with whether or not John Coffey killed those two little girls?
I took off one of my shoes and gave it to him last night, I said. After the execution, this was, when things had settled back down a little. I pushed it through the bars, and he picked it up in those big hands of his. I told him to tie it. I had to make sure, you see, because all our problem children normally wear is slippers. A man who really wants to commit suicide can do it with shoelaces if he's dedicated. That's something all of us know. They were nodding. He put it on his lap and got the ends of the laces crossed over all right, but then he was stuck. He said he was pretty sure someone had showed him how to do it when he was a lad, maybe his father or maybe one of the boyfriends his mother had after the father was gone, but he'd forgot the knack.
I'm with Brutal. I still don't see what your shoe has to do with whether or not Coffey killed the Dedrick twins, Dean said.
So I went over the story of the abduction and murder again, what I'd read that hot day in the prison library with my groin sizzling and Gibbons snoring in the corner, and all that the reporter Hammersmith told me later. The Dedrick's dog wasn't much of a biter, but it was a world-class barker, I said. The man who took the girls kept it quiet by feeding it sausages. He crept a little closer every time he gave it one, I imagine, and while the mutt was eating the last one, he reached out, grabbed it by the head, and twisted, broke its neck. Later, when they caught up with Coffey, the deputy in charge of the posse, Rob McGee, his name was, spotted a bulge in the chest pocket of the bibles Coffey was wearing. McGee thought at first it might be a gun. Coffey said it was a lunch. And that's what it turned out to be, a couple of sandwiches and a pickle, wrapped up in newspaper and tied with butcher's string. Coffey couldn't remember who gave it to him, only that it was a woman wearing an apron.
Sandwiches and a pickle, but no sausages, Brutal said.
No sausages, I agreed.
Course not, Dean said. He fed those to the dog.
Well, that's what the prosecutor said at the trial, I agreed. But if Coffey opened his lunch and fed the sausages to the dog, how'd he tie the newspaper back up again with that butcher's twine? I don't know when he even would have had the chance, but leave that out of it for the time being. This man can't even tie a simple granny knot. There was a long moment of thunderstruck silence, broken at last by Brutus.
Holy shit, he said in a low voice.
How come no one brought that up at the trial?
Nobody thought of it, I said,
and found myself again thinking of Hammersmith, the reporter. Hammersmith, who had been to college in Bowling Green. Hammersmith, who liked to think of himself as enlightened. Hammersmith, who had told me that mongrel dogs and Negroes were about the same, that either might take a chomp out of you suddenly and for no reason. Except he kept calling them your Negroes, as if they were still property, but not his property. No, not his, never his. And at that time, the South was full of Hammersmiths. Nobody was really equipped to think of it, Coffey's own attorney included.
But you did, Harry said. God damn, boys, we're sitting here with Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
He sounded simultaneously joshing and awed.
Oh, put a cork in it, I said.
I wouldn't have thought of it either, if I hadn't put together what he told Deputy McGee that day with what he said after he cured my infection and what he said after he healed the mouse.
What?
Dean said. When I went into his cell, it was like I was hypnotized. I didn't feel like I could have stopped doing what he wanted even if I'd tried.
I don't like the sound of that,
Harry said and shifted uneasily in his seat. I asked him what he wanted, and he said, just to help. I remember that very clearly. And when it was over and I was better, he knew. I helped it, he said. I helped it, didn't I? Brutal was nodding.
Just like with the mouse.
You said you helped it, and Coffee said it back to you like he was a parrot. I helped Dell's mouse. Is that when you knew? It was, wasn't it?